Good day and welcome to this segment of the KSPC Public Affairs blog focusing on the economy, small business, and entrepreneurship. This installment I'm calling Through the Looking Glass. My name is Caleb Kirsch, and I'm a second-year MBA student at the Drucker School of Management of the Claremont Graduate University in Claremont, California. With this program, I will strive to illuminate issues that are obscured by the talking heads you will find elsewhere. In the first show, we set the stage by looking at the current state of the economy, discussing some of the contributors to the financial crisis. Together, we will gain more insight into the various perspectives of people and their interests to understand not only how things are, but why they are the way we find them today, and we're going to highlight what can be done about it. My perspective is that everything is connected, so while the economy is the starting point, I intend to follow the trail of curiosity wherever it leads us. This week, we will take a brief look at the headlines in the news relevant to the economy, and that will lead us into today's main topic, where we'll look more at the causes of the financial crisis, what the near-term future holds, and what can be done. I have a clip from an economist that talks about how bad the subprime financial crisis really is, how it is going to continue for some time, and what can and should be done. Then, I am going to take things in a more speculative direction and look at what people on the ground can do and where some bright spots in the economy exist. First, the news. Last week, Bank of America announced that it would halt foreclosures in all 50 states, according to CNBC and the Wall Street Journal. Previously, the country's biggest banks announced that they would be halting foreclosures in 23 states, saying it needed to review foreclosure documents for potential errors. The decision comes as a foreclosure crisis threatens the nation's housing market and larger economy. Already, foreclosure ambiguities have begun to stall sales of foreclosed properties in many states. The New York Times described the case of a woman who was about to move into a house when Fannie Mae declared the property's foreclosure might not have been valid, and she was told to wait. While owners of foreclosed homes may be glad to see these proceedings halted, buyers of those homes and the larger housing market are suffering. Also this week, it was announced that in September, the economy lost 95,000 jobs, 77,000 of which were temporary census positions. The unemployment rate held at 9.6%. Also, downward revisions in payroll employment for July and August brought the numbers down 110,000 additional fewer jobs. While the overall rate of unemployment did not change in September, different populations were not similarly affected by employment changes. The employment to population ratio was unchanged at 58.5%, while white adults saw relatively little change in their EPOPs. The EPOP for black men aged 20 and over fell 0.5 percentage points in the month and 2.6 percentage points for African American teens. The fall in the latter is particularly striking, as only 16.2% of black teens were employed as recently as May. 10 years ago, 29.5% of black teens were employed compared to 11.7% in September. Though the private sector created 64,000 jobs in September, non-census employment in federal, state, and local government fell by 82,000. Almost the entire loss of non-census government jobs came at the local level, with 49,800 jobs lost in education and 26,300 lost in the rest of local government. In addition, this employment report announced the preliminary revisions to the payroll jobs numbers for March. According to the estimate, early this year, there were 366,000 fewer jobs than previously reported, with particularly large downward revisions to unemployment in construction and manufacturing in a proportionally smaller 144,000 downward revision in trade and transportation. This report from Truth Out. Also from Truth Out, it's reported that in 15 states with the largest prison populations, due to the pressure states are facing of reduced budgets, people are being held in virtual debtors' prisons for being unable to pay their legal fees, including charges for use of public defenders, a guaranteed right in the United States. Senior ACLU staff attorney Eric Balaban stated, quote, "Incarcerating people simply because they cannot afford to pay their legal debts is not only unconstitutional, but also has a devastating impact upon men and women whose only crime is that they are poor. Apparently, many states view the fees as a method for helping to alleviate budget deficits. In New Orleans, Louisiana, legal fines comprise almost two-thirds of criminal courts' operating budgets." The ACLU found in its report called In for a Penny, The Rise of America's New Debtor Prisons, that jailing individuals for failing to pay legal fees actually places the financial burden on the state, wasting taxpayer money and resources to keep those individuals in jail or on public welfare as they struggle to pay their overwhelming debts. And Bloomberg News is reporting that the FDIC is preparing to sue executives of the banks that failed since the financial crisis. After sending heads-up letters to potential targets of litigation, the FDIC has bared its claws, saying, we could walk into court tomorrow and file the lawsuits, FDIC General Counsel Richard Osterman told Bloomberg. During the savings and loan crisis of the 1980s, the FDIC sued executives for more than 24% of the banks that failed. Court victories for the agency would force bank executives to pay some portion of the compensation they received from their banks. Government regulators endowed with new powers by the financial reform legislation in July are currently drafting rules for curbing executive pay, which regulators say in the past has inspired excessive risk-taking. Those are some of the financial news headlines for the week ending October 10th, 2010. That leads us into our next segment, which covers the state of the financial crisis as seen by noted risk analyst Chris Wallen, who spoke for the American Enterprise Institute, known for their advocacy of neoconservative perspectives. What I take from that is that even the most conservative people in the country are unlikely to refute what he has to say. And I found that what he has to say has a certain resonance with what many people on Main Street have been saying. Things are going to get worse before they get better, and the financial regulations enacted in July haven't yet gotten to the crux of the crisis. Let's hear what he has to say.
Over lunch, we talked about a great book that I used in the book project I just finished. My book's called Inflated, How Money and Debt Built the American Dream. And the panelists have all just confirmed that I was probably a little bit too nice in the book. My friend Nouriel Roubini got home from one of his epic road trips and wrote a foreword for the book, so I'm quite excited about it. The chart that Desmond had that showed the diminution of the drop in private debt after the Great Depression, I think is very relevant here because, you know, what we need to recall is that from the crash in 29 through World War II, there was no recovery in private debt. In fact, it basically continued to go down because of political uncertainty. And I think Barack Obama is repeating that mistake in spades. In fact, both parties are repeating that mistake. Alex, if you would you give me the high sign at 10 minutes? And I'm going to stop talking about bank earnings. I'm going to give you guys a micro view to go along with all these macro views. And then I want to talk a little bit about QE and refinancing to go back to Desmond's point. Let's see here. Is the subprime crisis over? No. What we have done with HAMP, with modification, with forbearance, with a lot of other devices in the banking industry is we bought time. Unfortunately, our political class didn't realize that they were buying time other than in a political sense, and they did not do the next step. And I want to tell you right now, I'm going to end up as the bluebird of happiness today, because there is hope, and the hope lies in restructuring. We have to get a new set of political leadership in this country who are willing to start telling people the truth again, stop the big lie, and we have to start restructuring. And whoever does that first in the global marketplace is going to be ahead of the game. And I think the United States can do that. Now, I've got five charts. I'm going to go through them quickly. If you have questions, I'll be happy to talk to you afterwards. But I'm trying to illustrate the stresses in the banking system and what is, I think, really going on in the background. Now, there's really a couple of different parts to any credit cycle, but you know when you're at the end, when you see the efficiency, that is to say the operational efficiency of banks deteriorating, because that's when they're dealing with foreclosures, they're taking physical possession of properties, and they're selling them. It's a very labor-intensive activity. Banks are not designed for this. Banks are meant to be liquid entities that deal in financial instruments. They're not designed to be REITs. But that's what our banks are becoming. We are turning all of our banks, Fannie and Freddie, into owners and operators of real estate. And this stress is going to overwhelm them. In fact, I said in this deck, and I will say it again, I think that Bank of America and Wells Fargo are going to have to be restructured for the simple reason that the massive flow of real property and claims related to their securitization activities are just going to be mind-boggling. You know, both Bank of America and Wells Fargo have over $1 trillion in securitizations that they sold to Fannie and Freddie. And when Fannie and Freddie have a loan go bad that they were sold by a bank, they go back to the bank and they say, buy it back from me. That's a cash expense. So let's take a look at this first chart. If you look at the circles, those first two,
Chris, just to explain for the audience what this ratio is that we're looking at here.
Efficiency is the dollar cost of revenue. It's how much it costs a bank to generate a dollar of revenue. It's a very simple illustration of the cost of running the bank, salary, running the branches, everything involved in SG&A, if you will, for a company.
Okay, so to help the radio listener, that's you out, I just want to describe couple of slides that he's showing. On his first slide, he talks about the increasing challenge of efficiency for the banks, because the banks are used to simply dealing with liquid assets. You put your money in, you get it out, they make a little bit of money off of having that money there to loan to other people. Then they also make money on the loans themselves. So his first slide talks about three stages of the banking crisis, the first being stress on liquidity, basically due to the different institutions getting more nervous because of the increased threat of default by other banks. So the banks are afraid to lend to each other, and so they stop lending to each other, and you have a problem with liquidity. And that's not something that the consumer faced, but that the big banks were dealing with each other. And then the second stage that he mentions, I'll just read the quote. The second stage involved stress on capital via charge-offs and loan loss reserves, both of which drove banks into record levels of loss. So first they're scared, then they're losing. Then the third stage, he says, of the banking crisis involves degradation of bank operating efficiency as restructuring accelerates, expenses rise, and lenders involuntarily become non-operating REITs. REITs means basically a real estate investment trust. And what that is an organization that simply manages real estate investments for profit. So his chart, and then we'll get back to his speech. His chart shows that over a period from the mid-80s to the present, that there have been certain times that with very big banks, there have only been a few times that their operating efficiency has been seriously impacted. And as the banks now have to deal with all of these foreclosures, they actually have to start managing real estate, which is not what they're good at and not what they're supposed to do. So their operating efficiency goes down. In other words, they have to put more money in to keep making money, and that's a big problem, as he's
now back in the 80s, when we had the peaks after the two major recessions in the early 80s and in the mid-90s, you can see that the efficiency, this is for large banks, over $10 billion in total assets, got up into the 70% range, which was serious. That meant that the bank was in serious operational stress. But look where we are today. We're already up in the 70s for the large bank peer group. And we're not done yet. In fact, we're just starting. If you take Lori Goodman's prediction as being somewhat accurate, and I think she's the best in the business, what we're talking about is only 25% of total foreclosures and sales of foreclosed properties have actually been accomplished. So we still have three quarters of the task ahead of us. If you see where we are today, up around 70% efficiency for the entire large bank peer group, where are we going to be next year? We're going to be close to 100%, in my opinion. And what that means is that on a cash flow basis, these banks are going to be losing money. And I think that the government is going to have to step in because, going back to Nouriel's point, the market is not going to wait. Now let's go on to the second chart. The Fed has essentially been trying to subsidize the losses of banks by keeping their net interest margin wide. And they have constantly referred to this. They say, and my clients say the same thing, God, Chris, net interest margins are at record levels. Isn't this going to help the banks? And the answer is yes. The Fed is transferring something like $750 billion a year from consumers and corporate savers to the banking industry to subsidize their losses. We're not going to see a recovery in consumer demand until that ends. If you take grandma's money away and she's just got enough left to buy food, then obviously the grandkids aren't going to get nice gifts at Christmas time, are they? But this is what the Fed is doing. Now let me go to this second chart.
What he was just referring to about grandma not having as much money, basically as the Fed keeps interest rates extremely low, virtually zero, banks are benefiting because they have a low cost of loaning the money out, but people who save money, be they consumers or corporate savers, are basically getting the short end of the stick because interest rates are so low. The chart that he is about to refer to basically has two curves on it. One is the total interest income from the banks, and one a little bit lower is total interest expense. And what he's highlighting is that there are certain economists that are saying, oh, the banks are making more money than ever, or just as much as they did at the peak of the financial crisis. But what he will get into is that basically, because interest rates are so low right now, he believes that banks aren't able to make enough money to support all of the activities that they have going on, including processing of the foreclosures. So let's go back to the talk.
This was the peak in net interest revenue at the top. That's the blue line. That's revenue. That's expense. And you can see during the peak of the boom, banks in the United States reached almost $190 billion in gross interest revenue. That's a lot. A lot of this was enhanced with leverage, over-the-counter derivatives, all sorts of artifices to generate cash flow. But look what's happened since. We've gone from almost $190 billion down to $135 billion in dollar terms. Now, the economists at the Board of Governors will brag to you that the spread between the cost of funds and the revenue in the banks is wider than it was 4 years ago. But the dollar flow going through the bank is now 35% less. How do you feel about that? Does that make you feel good? But my fear is that the economists at the Board of Governors don't understand this, because all they look at is economic data. They never look at anything except in percentages. But if they looked at it in actual dollars, what they would see is that the cash flow going through the interest rate side of the book is falling very dramatically. Why? Zero interest rates. If you keep Fed policy where it is today, we're going to see this gross revenue number down in the 80s. Which means that the government will be taking over large banks. They cannot survive at that level, in my opinion. Now, let's go on to the next happy chart, non-interest income.
This chart basically has one line, which is the total non-interest expense, over another line that is the total non-interest income. In other words, the expenses are somewhat higher than the income that the banks make. This is referring to income and expenses that do not involve loans.
The other side of a bank, besides just making money between the cost of funds and lending it to you, are other services that they provide. Could be trust department, could be securitization, investment banking fees, anything that's not interest related. Now let's go to the chart. This is different from the last chart we were looking at. The red line, that's expense. The blue line is the revenue. What's wrong with this chart? Obviously, now, there's nothing wrong with this. Most banks don't generate enough non-interest income to support the bank. In other words, salaries, expenses, everything else. That's normal. The big banks like Bank of New York, State Street, who have a big trust department or other activities that are not related to interest, they are in a position where they can actually run the bank and be indifferent to interest earnings. But generally, the industry looks like this. Now, what you see is during the crisis years, the expenses peaked and the revenue troughed. Look at those deviations, because normally this is a very boring data series. This does not move around a lot. When you see these kind of skews in this data series in what should be a very boring part of the banking industry, that tells you that there is extraordinary instability in the system, and there is extraordinary instability in the businesses of these institutions. So again, where do you suppose we're going to be next year? I suspect that revenue on the non-interest side of the bank is going to fall. And because of what we were talking about before, foreclosures, the cost side of the bank, which includes servicing, it includes claims by Fannie and Freddie for the repurchase of defaulted loans, are going to surge. You will see if you go through the Edgar filings for the big banks, there's a new line item in non-interest expense. It's called reserve for loan repurchases. And it is getting enormous. At the end of the second quarter, Bank of America admitted to having something like $12 billion in claims for both Fannie Freddie collateral and private label collateral. That's what they admit. Let's go to the next chart. My favorite. This is actually a chart that we generate off of our model. This is called exposure at default. This is a Basel II term. And very simply, what it means is unused credit lines. There's four data series that the FDIC collects, two for consumers, two for institutional. So let's take a look at the big banks, because they all tell you that they're trying to lend, right? Do you all believe that? No, obviously not. Bank of America, the peer group, Citi and JP Morgan. During the boom, Citi, which was always the outlier in this group, had $2.50 of unused credit out there for every dollar in loans that they had on their book. Big credit card book, big unsecured consumer book. They want you to use the credit. That's the business. If you look at the blue line, that's Bank of America before they bought MBNA. They didn't have a big credit card book before then. Look what it did to their unused lines. They went from less than 100%. In other words, Bank of America only gave their customers 80 cents for an unused credit line for every dollar they had on the book. There are a lot of little community banks, by the way, that have zero. If you look at Hudson City Savings, for example, they never give their customers credit lines, and they never have bad defaults.
Chris, 10 minutes.
We're at 10 minutes. So obviously, if you look at the end here, all of the big banks are now clustered around 100-150%, which means they've pulled in their credit lines. They're trying to protect themselves from default. That's all that is. It tells you how they feel about their customers. Because otherwise, they would expand these because they want people to use the credit. That's how they make money. So let me switch gears here, because something that came up before about the Fed really needs to be said. We have a comment on our website today that goes into this in detail, and I talk about my mortgage. A lot of you have been reading in the paper about the foreclosure crisis. We have politicians now calling for investigations and witch hunts. RICO suits are being filed against banks, et cetera, et cetera. And yes, it's horrible. People are losing their homes. Banks are doing stupid things because nobody knows who owns the loan. We could go on all afternoon talking about perfection of collateral liens. But suffice to say, if you go pull my record, which I did last week, what you find is that when the Bank of New York wrote my mortgage and sold it to Lehman Brothers, Lehman Brothers never sent somebody down to the courthouse in White Plains to do a change in the recordation of the lien on the note. It still says Bank of New York. Okay? That's the foreclosure problem in a nutshell. But what I want to focus on instead is the Fed. Our friends at the Federal Reserve Board are going to, as you know, it was said earlier, go into another cycle of quantitative easing because they want to help the U.S. economy by pushing rates down. The problem is that the banks are in such trouble that instead of allowing the millions of households out there that are making their loan payments and don't have very high LTVs to refinance, they're piling on fees, loan-level pricing from Fannie and Freddie, and other artifices. So instead of that bank working for half a point when they wrote a mortgage in 2005, they're working for 4 to 5 points now. When they quote you 3.5% on that refi, by the time they actually hand you the document, the actual effective rate is going to be over 6%. Now, this is a cartel, my friends. The Obama administration is suing American Express over some alleged illegal practices in terms of antitrust vis-a-vis credit cards. But what they ought to be doing is suing Fannie and Freddie, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, and Wells Fargo for operating a cartel in mortgage refinance. You know, the Fed's efforts to reflate this economy are going to be stymied until we can start to refinance households that deserve to be refinanced. I'm not talking about people who ought to be short-sold and gotten out of their homes. I think that's the right answer for a lot of people. But if you have somebody who's wanting to make the payments, who wants to stay in the house, we need to refinance them now. Because if we don't, these are going to turn into defaults, and Lori Goodman's predictions are going to be optimistic. And I'm going to stop there.
Thank you, Chris. I'll just say that last point really fits in with Tom's slide of the affordability of new houses. So we get this paradox. The affordability is very high, which means you should be getting a lot of refinances.
Well, the thing
and
is,
that,
Alex,
that comes back to
your every point. Recession we've had in this country since World War II, the central bank eased and households became more liquid. Maybe that was a mistake. Maybe we created an expectation that was unreasonable. But this time around, even with the rates as low as they are, you're not seeing households get a benefit.
So that wraps up Chris Wallen's talk on his perspective on the subprime crisis and the work left to do. Basically, to summarize what he talked about, operating costs for the banks are going to rise dramatically due to the foreclosures and defaults that they have yet to process. Lori Goodman of Amherst Securities predicts that 1 in 5 mortgages could go into foreclosure without radical action. The banks, because of their increasing operating costs, are eventually going to force the U.S. government to restructure some of the largest lenders. Finally, it may take up to 4 to 5 years for the cycle of liquidation to deflate the subprime housing bubble. And I wanted to discuss some of the bright spots in the economy and some hopeful things, but we will have to delay that until next week when we will be looking at the potential of the green economy, a number of different suggestions that the Huffington Post has made to get the economy moving again. And hopefully we will have a guest or two who will discuss these topics with us. So thanks again for joining me. This has been Caleb Kirsch. Feel free to send feedback to me at caleb.kirsch@cgu.edu. That's caleb.kersh@cgu.edu.